You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz. This is lecture 16, entitled The True Attitude to Karma, given in Vienna on the 8th of February, 1912. I had good reason to emphasize at the end of each of the two public lectures that anthroposophy must not be regarded merely as a theory or a science, nor only as knowledge in the ordinary sense. It is rather something that can be transformed in the soul into actual life, into an elixir of life. What really matters, more than simply acquiring knowledge through anthroposophy, is that forces flow into us from anthroposophy, which help us not only in ordinary physical existence, but through the whole compass of life, including physical existence and the discarnate condition between death and a new birth. The more we feel that anthroposophy bestows upon us forces which strengthen and enrich life itself, the more truly do we understand it. When such a statement is made, people may ask, if anthroposophy is to be a power that strengthens and invigorates life, why is it necessary to absorb all this apparently theoretical knowledge? Why do we have to bother in our group meetings with all sorts of details about past planetary embodiments of the Earth? Why is it necessary to learn about things that happened in the remote past? Why are we also expected to familiarize ourselves with the more intimate, intangible laws of reincarnation, karma, and so forth? Many people might think that anthroposophy is just another kind of science, on a par with the many sciences existing in outer physical life. Now, in answering this question, which has been mentioned here because it is very likely to be asked, we must put aside all considerations of comfort and convenience. Scrupulous self-examination is necessary to find whether or not such questions are tainted by that habitual slackness in life which we know only too well. People are often fundamentally unwilling to learn, unwilling to take hold of the spiritual, because this is inconvenient. And so we must ask ourselves whether this fear of inconvenience and discomfort is creeping into such questions. Let us admit that we really do think occasionally that there might be an easier path to anthroposophy than all that is presented, for example, in our literature. It is often said lightheartedly that, after all, a person need only know himself, need only try to be a good and righteous human being, and then he is a sufficiently good anthroposophist. Yes, my dear friends, but precisely this gives us the deeper knowledge that there is, in fact, nothing more difficult than to be a good person, and that nothing needs so much preparation and hard work as attaining this ideal. And the truth about self-knowledge is certainly not something that can be answered in a moment, as so many people would like to think. Today, therefore, we will consider certain questions which are often expressed in the way suggested above. We will think of how anthroposophy comes to us, seemingly, as a body of teaching, a science, although in essence it brings self-knowledge and the aspiration to become good and righteous human beings. And to this end, it is important to study from different points of view how anthroposophy can flow into life. Let us consider one of life's vital questions. I am not referring to anything in the domain of science, but to a question arising in our everyday lives, that of consolation for suffering, for lack of satisfaction in life. How, for example, can anthroposophy bring consolation to people in distress when they need it? Every individual must, of course, apply what can be said about such matters to his own particular case. In addressing a number of people, one can only speak in a general sense. Why do we need consolation in life? because something may distress us, because we have to suffer and undergo painful experiences. Now, it is natural for us to feel that something in us rebels against this suffering, and we ask, quote, "Why have I to bear it? Why has it fallen to my lot? Could my life not have been without pain? Could it not have brought me contentment?" Close quote. Anyone who puts the question in this way can only find an answer when he understands the nature of human karma, of human destiny. Why do we suffer? And I am referring not only to outer suffering, but also to inner suffering, due to a sense of failure, And I am referring not only to outer suffering, but also to inner suffering, due to a sense of failure to do ourselves justice, or find our proper bearings in life. This is what I mean by inner suffering. Why does life bring so much that leaves us unsatisfied? Study the laws of karma. Study of the laws of karma will make it clear to us that something underlies our sufferings, something that can be illustrated by an example drawn from ordinary life between birth and death. I have given this example more than once. Suppose a young man has lived up to the age of 18 or so, entirely dependent on his father. His life has been happy and carefree. He has had everything he wanted. Then the father loses his fortune, becomes bankrupt, and the youth is obliged to set about learning something, to exert himself. Life brings him many sufferings and deprivations. It is readily understandable that the sufferings are not at all to his liking. But now, think of him at the age of 50. Because circumstances obliged him to learn something in his youth, he has turned into a decent, self-respecting human being. He has found his feet in life and can say to himself, quote, "My attitude to the sufferings and deprivations was natural at the time, but now I think quite differently about them. I realize now that the sufferings would not have come to me if in those days I had possessed all the virtues, even the very circumscribed ones, of a boy of 18. If no suffering had come my way, I should have remained a good-for-nothing. It was the sufferings that changed my imperfections into something far better. It is due to the suffering that I am not the same human being I was 40 years ago. What was it then that joined forces in me at that time? My own imperfections and my suffering joined forces. And my imperfections sought out the suffering so that they might be removed and transformed into virtues." Close quote. This attitude can even arise from quite an ordinary view of life between birth and death. And if we think deeply about life as a whole, facing our karma in the way described in the lecture yesterday, we shall be convinced that our imperfections seek out our sufferings. The vast majority of sufferings are indeed sought out by the imperfections we have brought with us from earlier incarnations. And because of these imperfections, a wiser being within us seeks for the path leading to our sufferings. For it is a golden rule in life that as human beings we constantly have within us a being who is much wiser, much cleverer than ourselves. The part of us we call I in ordinary life has far less wisdom, and if faced with the alternative of seeking either pain or happiness, would certainly choose the path to happiness. The wiser being operates in the depths of subconscious life, to which ordinary consciousness does not extend. This wiser being diverts our gaze from the path to superficial happiness and kindles within us a magic power which, without our conscious knowledge, leads us toward suffering. But what does this mean, without our conscious knowledge? It means that the wiser being is prevailing over the less wise one, and this wiser being invariably acts within us so that it leads our imperfections to our sufferings, allowing us to suffer because every outer and inner suffering roots out some imperfection and leads to greater perfection. We may be willing to accept such principles in theory, but that is not of much account. A great deal is achieved, however, if in certain solemn and dedicated moments of life we try strenuously to make such principles the very life-blood of the soul. In the hurry and bustle, the work and the duties of ordinary life, this is not always possible. Under these circumstances, we cannot always oust the being of lesser wisdom, who is, after all, part of us. But in certain deliberately chosen moments, however short they may be, we shall be able to say to ourselves, quote, "I will turn away from the hubbub of outer life and view my sufferings in such a way that I realize how the wiser being within me has been drawn to them by a magic power, how I imposed upon myself certain pain without which I should not have overcome this or that imperfection." Close quote. A feeling of the peace inherent in wisdom will then arise, bringing the realization that even when the world seems full of suffering, there too it is full of wisdom. In this way life is enriched through anthroposophy. We may forget it again in the affairs of outward life, but if we do not forget it altogether and repeat the exercise steadfastly, we shall find that a kind of seed has been laid in the soul, and that many a feeling of sadness and depression changes into a more positive attitude, into strength and energy. And then out of such quiet moments in life, we will acquire more harmonious souls and become stronger individuals. Then we may pass on to something else. But the anthroposophist should make it a rule to devote himself to these other thoughts only when the attitude that comforts him in his suffering has become alive within him. We may turn, then, to think about the happiness and joys of life. Someone who adopts, toward his destiny, the attitude that he himself has willed his sufferings will have a strange experience when he comes to think about his joy and happiness. It is not as easy for him here as it is in the case of his sufferings. It is easy, after all, to find a consolation for suffering, and anyone who feels doubtful has only to persevere. But it will be difficult to find the right attitude to happiness and joy. However strongly someone may bring himself to feel that he has willed his suffering, when he applies this mood of soul to his happiness and joy, he will not be able to avoid a sense of shame. He will feel thoroughly ashamed. And he can only rid himself of this feeling of shame by saying to himself, quote, "No, I have certainly not earned my joy and happiness through my own karma." Close quote. This is the only cure. For otherwise the shame may be so intense that it almost shatters the soul. The only salvation is not to attribute our joys to the wiser being within us. This thought will convince us that we are on the right road, because the feeling of shame passes away. It is really so. Happiness and joy in life are bestowed by the wise guidance of the worlds, without our assistance, as something we must receive as grace, always recognizing that the purpose is to give us our place in the whole scheme of things. Joy and happiness should so work upon us in the celebratory moments of life, in moments of seclusion, that we feel them as grace. Grace bestowed by the supreme powers of the world, who want to receive us into themselves. While our pain and suffering bring us to ourselves, make us more fully ourselves, through joy and happiness, provided we consider them as grace, we develop the feeling of peaceful security in the arms of the divine powers of the world, and the only worthy attitude is one of thankfulness. Nobody who is in quiet hours of self-contemplation ascribes happiness and joy to his own karma will unfold the right attitude to such experiences. If he ascribes joy and happiness to his karma, He is succumbing to a fallacy which weakens and paralyzes the spiritual within him. The slightest thought that we have deserved happiness or delight weakens and cripples us inwardly. These words may seem harsh, for many who attribute suffering to their own will and individuality would like to be masters of themselves too in the experiences of happiness and joy. But even a cursory glance at life will indicate that by their very nature joy and happiness tend to obliterate something in us. This weakening effect of delights and joys in life is graphically described in title Faust by the words, quote, "And so from longing to delight I reel, and even in delight I pine for longing," close quote. And anybody who gives any thought to the influence of joy, taken in the personal sense, will realize that there is something in joy that transports us and erases our actual self. This is not meant to be a sermon against joy, or a suggestion that it would be good to torture ourselves with red-hot pincers or the like. Certainly not. To recognize something for what it really is does not mean that we must flee from it. It is not a question of running away from joy, but of receiving it calmly whenever it comes to us. We must learn to feel it as grace. And the more we do so, the better it will be, for we shall enter more deeply into the divine. These words are said, therefore, not in order to preach asceticism, but to awaken the right mood toward happiness and joy. If anyone were to say, quote, "Joy and happiness have a weakening, deadening effect, therefore I will flee from them," close quote, which is the attitude of false asceticism and a form of self-torture, such a person would be fleeing from the grace bestowed upon him by the gods. And in truth, the self-flagellation practiced by ascetics, monks, and nuns in olden days was a form of resistance against the gods. We must learn to regard suffering as something brought by our karma, and to feel happiness as grace that the divine can send down to us. Joy and happiness should be to us the sign of how closely the gods have drawn us to themselves. Suffering and pain should be the sign of how remote we are from the goal we need to attain as intelligent human beings. Such is the true attitude to karma, and without it, we shall make no real progress in life. Whenever the world bestows upon us the good and the beautiful, we must feel that behind this world stand those powers of whom the Bible says, quote, "And they looked at the world, and they saw that it was good," close quote. But inasmuch as we experience pain and suffering, we must recognize what, in the course of incarnations, man has made of the world, which in the beginning was good, and what he must contribute toward its betterment, by educating himself to bear pain with purpose and energy. What has been described are two ways of accepting our karma. In a certain respect, our karma consists of suffering and joys, and we relate ourselves to our karma with the right attitude when we can consider it as something we really wanted, and when we can confront our sufferings and joys with a proper understanding. But a review of karma can be extended further, which we shall do today and tomorrow. Karma does not reveal itself only in the form of experiences of suffering or joy. As our life runs its course, we encounter, in a way that can only be regarded as karmic, many human beings with whom, for example, we make a fleeting acquaintance, others who, as relatives or close friends, are connected with us for a considerable period of our life. We meet human beings who, in our dealings with them, bring sufferings and hindrances to our path. Or again, we meet others whom we can help and who can help us. The relationships are manifold. We must regard these circumstances, too, as having been brought about by the will of the wiser being within us. The will, for example, to meet a human being who seems to run across our path accidentally and with whom we have something to adjust or settle in life. What is it that makes the wiser being in us wish to meet this particular person? The only intelligent line of thought is that we want to come across him because we have done so before in an earlier life, and our relationship had already begun then. Nor need the beginning have been in the immediately preceding life. It may have been very much earlier. Because in a past life we have had dealings of some kind with this person, because we may have been in some way indebted to him, we are led to him again by the wiser being within us, as if by magic power. Here, of course, we enter a very diverse and extremely complicated domain, of which it is only possible to speak in general terms. But all the indications given here are the actual results of clairvoyant investigation. The indications will be useful to every individual, because he will be able to particularize and apply what is said to his own life. A remarkable fact comes to light. About the middle of life, the ascending curve passes over into the descending curve. This is the time when the forces of youth are spent and we pass over a certain zenith to the descending curve. This point of time, which occurs in the 30s, cannot be laid down with absolute finality, but the principle holds good for everyone. It is the period of life when we live most intensely on the physical plane. In this connection, we may easily be deluded. It will be clear that life before this point of time has been a process of bringing out what we have brought with us into the present incarnation. This process has been going on since childhood, although it is less marked as the years go by. We have chiseled out our life, have been nourished, as it were, by the forces brought from the spiritual world. These forces, however, are spent by the point of time referred to. Observation of the descending line of life reveals that we now proceed to harvest and work over what has been learned in the school of life, in order to carry it with us into the next incarnation. This is something we take into the spiritual world. In the earlier period, we were taking something from the spiritual world. It is in the middle period that we are most deeply involved in the physical world, most engrossed in the affairs of outer life. We have passed through our apprenticeship, as it were, and are in direct contact with the world. We have our life in our own hands. At this period, we are taken up with ourselves, concerned more closely than at any other time with our own external affairs and with our relation to the outer world. But this relation with the world is created by the intellect and the impulses of will which derive from the intellect. In other words, those elements of our being which are most alien to the spiritual worlds, to which the spiritual worlds remain closed. In the middle of life, we are, as it were, farthest away from the spiritual. A certain striking fact presents itself to occult research. Investigations of the kind of encounters and relationships with other human beings that arise in the middle of life shows curiously that these are the people with whom we were together at the beginning of our life, in our very earliest childhood, in the previous incarnation, or in a still earlier one. The fact has emerged that in the middle of life, as a rule it is so, but not always, we encounter through outward karmic circumstances those people who in an earlier life were our parents. It is very rarely indeed that we are brought together in earliest childhood with those who were previously our parents. We meet them in the middle of life. This certainly seems strange, but it is the case, and a very great deal is gained for life if we will only try to put such a general rule to the test and adjust our thoughts accordingly. When a human being, let us say at about the age of 30, enters into some relationship with another, perhaps he falls in love, makes great friends, quarrels, or has some different kind of contact, a great deal will become comprehensible. If quite tentatively to begin with, he thinks about the possibility of the relationship to this person having once been that of child and parent. Conversely, another very remarkable fact comes to light. Those human beings with whom we were together in earliest childhood, parents, brothers and sisters, playmates, or others around us during early childhood, they, as a rule, are people with whom we formed some kind of relationship when we were about 30 or so in a previous incarnation. In very many cases, it is found that these people are our parents or brothers and sisters in the present incarnation. Curious as this may seem, just let us try to see how the principle squares with our own life, and we shall discover how much more understandable many things become. Even if the facts are otherwise, an experimental mistake will not amount to anything very serious. But if in solitary hours we look at life so that it is filled with meaning, we can gain a great deal. Obviously, we must not try to arrange life to our liking. We must not choose the people we like and assume that they may have been our parents. Prejudices must not falsify the real facts. You will see the danger we are exposed to and the many misconceptions that may creep in. We ought to educate ourselves to remain open-minded and unbiased. You may now ask what there is to be said about the descending curve of life. The striking fact has emerged that at the beginning of life, we meet those human beings with whom we were connected in the middle period of life in a previous incarnation. Further, that in the middle of the present life, we revive relationships which existed at the beginning of a preceding life. And now, what of the descending curve of life? During that period, we are led to people who may also, possibly, have had something to do with us in an earlier incarnation. They may, in that earlier incarnation, have played a part in occurrences of the kind that so frequently occur at a decisive point in life, let us say trials and sufferings caused by bitter disillusionments. In the second half of life, we may again be brought into contact with people who in some way or other were already connected with us. This meeting brings about a shifting of circumstances, and a lot that was set in motion in the earlier life is cleared up and resolved. These things are diverse and complex, and indicate that we should not adhere rigidly to any hard and fast pattern. This much, however, may be said. The nature of the karma that has been woven with those who come across our path, especially in the second half of life, is such that it cannot be absolved in one life. Suppose, for example, we have caused suffering to a human being in one life. We could easily imagine that in a subsequent life we shall be led to this person by the wiser being within us, so that we may make amends for what we have done to him. The circumstances of life, however, may not enable compensation to be made for everything, but often only for a part of it. This necessitates the operation of complicated factors, which enable such surviving remnants of karma to be adjusted and settled during the second half of life. This conception of karma can shed light upon our dealings and companionship with other human beings. But something further can be observed when we consider the course of our karma, something that in the two public lectures I referred to as the process of growing maturity, the acquisition of a real knowledge of life. We can use this phrase as long as it does not foster arrogance. Let us consider how we grow wiser. We can learn from our mistakes, and it is the best thing for us when this happens, because we do not often have the opportunity of applying the wisdom thus gained in one and the same life. Therefore, what we have learned from mistakes remains with us as strength for a later life. But the wisdom, the real knowledge of life that we can acquire, what is it really? I said yesterday that we cannot carry our thoughts and ideas with us directly from one life to the other. I said that even Plato could not take his ideas straight with him into his next incarnation. What we carry over with us takes the form of will, of feeling. And in reality, our thought and ideas, just like our mother tongue, come as something new in each life. For most thoughts and ideas live in the mother tongue, whence we acquire them. This life between birth and death supplies us with thoughts and ideas which always come from this particular stage of earth existence. But if this is so, we shall have to say to ourselves that it depends upon our karma. However many incarnations we go through, the ideas that arise in us are always dependent upon one incarnation as distinct from the others. Whatever wisdom may be living in your thoughts and ideas has been absorbed from without, is dependent upon the way karma has led you to language, nationality, and family. In the last resort, all our thoughts and ideas about the world are dependent on our karma. Very much lies in these words, for they indicate that whatever we may know in life, whatever knowledge we may amass, is something entirely personal, and that we can never transcend the personal by means of what we acquire for ourselves in life. In ordinary life, we never reach the level of the wiser being, but always remain at that of the less wise. Anyone who flatters himself that he can learn more about his higher self from what he acquires in the world is harboring a comfortable illusion. This actually means that we can gain no knowledge of our higher self from what we acquire in the course of our life. Very well then, how are we to attain any knowledge of the higher self? We must ask ourselves quite frankly, what do we really know? First of all, we know what we have learned from experience. This is all we know, and nothing else. A person who aspires to self-knowledge without realizing that his soul is only a mirror reflecting the outer world may persuade himself that by penetrating into his own being, he can find the higher self. Certainly, he will find something, but it is only what has come into him from outside. Laziness of thinking has no place in this quest. We must ask ourselves, what happens in those other worlds in which our higher self also lives? And this is none other than what has been said about the different incarnations of the earth, and everything else that spiritual science tells us. Just as we try to understand a child's soul by examining the child's relationship to its surroundings, so must we ask what the environment of the higher self is. It is spiritual science that tells us about these worlds, where our higher self is, in its account of Saturn and its secrets, of the moon and earth evolution, of reincarnation and karma, of Devakan and Kamaloka, and so on. This is the only way we can learn about our higher self, about the self which transcends the physical plane. Anyone who refuses to accept these secrets is merely pandering to his own ease. For it is an illusion to imagine you can discover the divine in yourself. Experiences of the outer world alone are stored within you, but the divine in us can only be found when we search in our soul for the mirrored world beyond the physical, so that those things which can sometimes prove difficult and uncomfortable to learn are nothing else but self-knowledge. And true anthroposophy is in reality true self-knowledge. From spiritual science we receive enlightenment about our own self. For where in reality is the self? Is the self within our skin? No, the self is poured out over the world. Everything that is and has been in the world is part and parcel of the self. We learn to know the self only when we learn to know the world. What seem to be mere theories are in truth the ways to self-knowledge. A person who thinks he can find the self by staring into his inner being says to himself, quote, "You must be good. You must be unselfish." Close quote. All well and good. But you will soon notice that he is getting more and more self-centered. On the other hand, struggling with the great secrets of existence, extricating oneself from the flattering self, accepting the reality of the higher worlds and the knowledge that can be obtained from them, all leads to true self-knowledge. When we think deeply about Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution, we lose ourselves in cosmic thought. Quote, "In your thinking, cosmic thoughts are living," close quote, says a soul who thinks anthroposophical thoughts, and adds, quote, "Lose yourself in cosmic thoughts," Close quote. The soul, creating out of anthroposophy, says, quote, in your feeling, cosmic powers are weaving, close quote, but also adds, quote, experience yourself through cosmic powers, close quote, not through powers which flatter. This experience will not come to someone who closes his eyes, saying, quote, I want to be a good human being, close quote. It will only come to those who open their eyes and their spiritual eyes also and see the powers working and weaving beyond themselves, realizing that they are embedded in these cosmic powers. And the soul that draws strength from anthroposophy says, quote, in your willing, cosmic beings are working, close quote, adding, quote, create yourselves anew from beings of will, close quote. And this will really happen if we grasp self-knowledge in this way. Then we shall really succeed in creating ourselves anew out of cosmic beings. Dry and abstract as this may seem, in reality it is no mere theory, but something that thrives and grows like a seed sown in the earth. Forces shoot out in every direction and become plant or tree. So it is indeed. The feelings that come to us through spiritual science give us the power to create ourselves anew. Quote, create yourself anew from beings of will, close quote. Thus does anthroposophy become the elixir of life, and our view of spirit worlds opens up. We shall draw strength from these worlds, and when we have drawn these forces into our being, then we shall know ourselves in all our depths. Only when we imbue ourselves with world knowledge can we take control of ourselves and advance step by step away from the less wise being within us, whose way is barred by the guardian of the threshold, and toward the wiser being, thus penetrating through all that is hidden from those who do not as yet have the will to be strong, which we can gain through anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 16.